people stand in line to see the boy king. How'd you get so funky? Did you do the monkey? Now if I'd known they'd line up just to see him, I'd taken all my money and bought me a museum.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
This is Don, your philosopher political science student and co-host on Radio Free Thinker.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and other co-host of Radio Free Thinker.
This is Daniel, economics student and a co-host of Radio Free Thinker.
Well, I'm seeing a connection here. My powerful brain is putting together the pieces of the puzzle. Well, welcome to Radio Free Thinker, everybody. Radio Free Thinker is the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, and Steve Martin singing funny songs about King Tut.
That's the main thing that we promote on
it. Yeah. Ethan, you said you really wanted to listen to the show, and I'm looking at it here. This is the live 1979 version. Why would we, on the premiere of our now hour-long show.
Woo! That's right.
Why would we be playing Steve Martin from, like, 30 years ago?
Well, I don't know if you guys realize...
Because it was awesome.
Well, that too. But new information has come to light. It turns out King Tut wasn't murdered.
What?
That's right.
You mean all those movies were lies?
You mean, like, the spear behind the grassy knoll was fraudulent?
It actually came from the scroll depository.
Is it bad that I had no idea King Tut was murdered?
Well, he wasn't, so...
Sweet, I was right.
Well, there you go. So I assume our listeners know who King Tut is. He was the boy pharaoh who, at the age of 10 and 1333 BCE, ruled for just 9 years in Egypt's history he died, of course. And then in 1922, his tomb was discovered by Howard Carter.
Thus launching the career of many Egyptologists, a huge craze in England and Egypt to study and find Egyptian antiquities and the mummy movies.
That's right. And if you ever had the opportunity to see the traveling King Tut exhibit, if you local museum, I advise you to do so. It's very, very gold and shiny. It's awesome. But anyway, so a new study. After 2 years of DNA testing and CAT scans on 16 mummies, including those of King Tut and his family, an article that's going to be published on Wednesday in the Journal of American Medical Association has discovered, among other things, that the boy king was not murdered, as previously thought, because he has a hole in the skull that was believed to be a process of the mummification, but it was actually a cleft palate, club foot, and malaria complications that killed the boy king.
Malaria? In Northern Africa?
What a surprise! Well, interesting enough, this is the oldest fossilized remains of malaria ever found.
Oh, cool.
So, quite an interesting discovery. King Tut was kind of a character of some speculation. People thought that he might have actually suffered from a syndrome called Marfan, which would have given him sort of feminine attributes, but this study has clearly debunked that speculation of some rare medical condition. So, interesting news from the world of archaeology, anthropology, and history.
You know, actually, I find King Tut is such a great example of being at the right place at the right time. I mean, really, the only thing
for him.
The only thing that makes King Tut really famous is the fact that he was discovered and he had a lot of his stuff when he was buried. Like,
oh, yeah.
He had all the artifacts and all that. He himself, I mean, he was a boy king. He only ruled for a certain time.
9 years.
From what we know, he wasn't necessarily a very effective king because he had issues, right? But he was in the right place and the right, he was forgettable enough time to be rediscovered and traveled.
Howard Carter was in the right place at the right time. I mean, the amazing thing with his tomb was that it was just, it hadn't been robbed yet, right? Like, that's why it's so, everyone remembers the big golden mask.
Well, it was buried underneath a crap ton of sand, wasn't it? I mean, I don't remember how Howard Carter found it.
Yeah, there's a story there.
The
I don't
know. Dowsing, I think it was.
Something with dynamite or
I don't know. There was the whole story of after the finding that everyone involved in that expedition died of the mummy's curse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I actually saw a really bad documentary on the Discovery Channel about that.
It turns out that there was one guy that was part of the expedition that died, like, of completely natural causes at a ripe, healthy old age. And sort of like, well, do you ignore him?
Well, there's all these, like, spooky stories of, like, Howard Carter's dog, like, dropping dead midnight in England or something, and probably didn't happen. Well, what else is going on? Don, you were telling me a very interesting story about some migrations.
Well, you know, and I'm not...
On the topic of ancient anthropology.
Exactly. Yes. You know, now part of this is, I didn't know this, and figure if I didn't know it, then obviously most people may not be aware of it, but there was a genome study done on the oldest human being. I believe it's about 5,000 years ago. A Dr. Esk Wilsov, for the Center of Excellence in Genomics in the University of Copenhagen, did a sequencing of this DNA from this from hair fragments that were discovered in northwestern Greenland. Now, what made this interesting to me was it was discovered that this particular group of immigrants to the New World came about 4,000 to 6,000 years ago, and that they were not the first or the last immigrants to come here, that the first people, of course, to come to the new land is believed to be Clovis people. Now, there's some controversy about that. And they came about 12, 15,000 years ago. Then about 8,000 years ago was another migration of what we call now Native Americans. Then apparently these people came who were originally from somewhere in north central Siberia, who came about, like I say, about 4,000 to 6,000 years. And then after that came the Inuit. Now, I was gobsmacked by my own ignorance and the fact that I always kind of assumed that Inuit and Native Americans were the same migration, differentiated because of climactic things, but they weren't. But they've done a complete genome study. They know he was a male, type A blood. But it was just, I just thought it was quite fascinating how many migrations had come into the New World, and this group itself is now extinct. They, just like the Clovis people, they no longer exist. And the only way that they could determine where he came from was doing this genomics, and it was quite interesting.
Well, isn't it that the Clovis people, aren't there archaeological, like, remains? We know they were there, but with this people, they're, like, culturally extinct. We actually didn't even know that they existed in the first place.
There is lots of evidence of, like, the culture of the Clovis people, like, tools and stuff left behind before any other group would likely have them, so there is evidence that the Clovis people were there.
Exactly.
But the thing that brings it down was the Clovis people culturally distinct or genetically distinct. And I think most people in the anthropological community think them very separate. But there's a lot of political issues that arise that if the Clovis people were quote-unquote the first people, then what happens to First Nation people? And there's political ramifications of that.
The Second Nations people?
Exactly. But although I think that's a red herring, because I think what happened during the latest European migration to the New World was in itself a bad thing, irrespective of who was here first, sort of thing.
Right, right. So then the implications being that there is potentially an undiscovered, separate, perhaps culturally separate group of people who were living in Canada's north, I would assume.
Exactly.
That we have no evidence of.
Right.
No idea about what kind of people they were.
No physical evidence. I mean, there's genomic evidence that... How does this work? They tested the genome of remains found in...
So they had this site in northern Greenland. And actually, there's a funny story about that. This guy knew about these artifacts, right? And he was just curious to do genetic testing on it. So he went there and he was trying to find some genetic material, right? You had some artifacts, spears and that kind of thing, right? But he couldn't find any. So he came back and saying, oh, you know, I went to Greenland and I couldn't find anything, right? And the guy said, guy he's talking to, my dad went up there and he did some stuff and he brought back some stuff and I'm pretty sure there's some hair in it, and if you just go down the street you can find yourself some hair. So he went down and he found the hair and he did research, and I guess the assumption was that they thought this was going to be some form of Inuit tribe or something, right? Maybe a different culture, but still Inuit nature. And they discovered, no, the genetic link was to this whole separate gene stock in Central America. It's also interesting the fact that it is the oldest genome for humans that they have, relatively complete. I think 80% of the genome's there.
Wow.
So
this could be, I think, a future topic for our show, discovering more about this mysterious cultures people that came to northern Canada.
Yeah, well, I thought it was, like, one thing that struck me as bizarre when I was listening to the show that was talking about this, they said extinct human. I'm going, well, we're still here. We're not extinct, are we? But, again, it was just the particular genetic group that went extinct.
Well, let's move on to, Rob, you have a very interesting story. Apparently, the Church of England has made a landmark decision.
Yes, at the General Synod in, I think, London, England, the Church of England has decided that evolution and the sort of scientific viewpoint is compatible with religious faith. And, I mean, in a very record decision, the council voted and it passed 241 votes to 2.
So is this a binding resolution? Like, will certain evangelical Christian pastors like shut up now?
Or? Like I know the Church of England recently had a big thing about conservatives and that breaking off, and the Catholic Church trying to peel off.
Yeah, the Catholic Church was like, "Hey, conservative members of the Church of England, come on over to our place. We'll take on your crazy beliefs." but yeah, I'm not sure how binding this is. But basically, they're just publicly announcing to the world that the Church of England thinks that science is cool with religion and they can coexist. They do specify in this article, it's from The Guardian that we're sourcing this from, and they basically said that they're distancing themselves from the sort of fundamental Christians because there's this they get a lot of press, fundamentalists and their biblical literalism, and the Church of England decided to do this, I think, partially as a way of saying, look, those guys are kind of nuts, you know, we're not like that, we think science is cool. They do specify that they reject scientism, the idea that science can explain every question. So they think that science and religion can coexist because religion answers some question that science doesn't have the tools to do so, and that many Christians do accept scientific theories. The guy who brought up the resolution in the General Synod was a Dr. Peter Kaplan, who was trained as a computer scientist, and he's part of the... he's part of the clergy. I'm not sure whether he's a bishop or a cardinal or something like that. But here's a quote from him. "I'm not suggesting that we should take the Bible, the inspired word of God, with anything other than the utmost seriousness and reverence. But we make a category mistake if we try to read it as a modern scientific textbook. We should be very wary of staking everything on proving or disproving a particular scientific proof."
There's actually another quote from that, which I think, where I'm starting to have some problems, I think this is, well, what would you call it, science washing or something? In that same article, an Oxford physicist, Dr. Anne Thomas Betts, says that, I don't look in science books to find out how to live, and I don't look in the Bible to find out about the Higgs boson. I have problems with that because, for example, they talk about creationism, intelligent design, and they have issues with that. And obviously, there's a certain point where mounting evidence goes against that. But the idea of right to life. Now, of course, there are moral issues to that, ethical issues, which are beyond science. But when you start bringing in something like, I still think they believe in the soul. I assume they believe in the soul.
Presumably.
And again, when you start having, I don't know, I'm going to call it make-believe things, because I think it is, and that starts influence how you live your life, and that's in spite of the evidence. I mean, they define the term faith as believing in some things that you don't know about, but that's not faith. Faith is believing in something in spite of the evidence, right? I mean, you can believe in things you don't know about, and that's a belief, but when you believe in it in spite of evidence, or, you know, then that's...
It's kind of, they're trying to have this where the, like, you know, science and religion are compatible. But that leads into the whole idea of the God of the gaps. If religion is basically the stuff that science doesn't have the tools to answer, well, science is constantly changing and expanding and figuring out ways of answering questions it didn't used to be able to. So that means that if you mark off your religion as that which science can't explain, it's going to be constantly shrinking until eventually you're going to have to decide whether, well, maybe there's something else to it, or maybe there's nothing else to it.
It seems to me like a large part of them doing this is just because, like, even this article, it references Richard Dawkins and sort of, like, the movement of that science can explain all these things. And it seems to me that they're simply just trying to keep many of their followers who are starting to, like, who really follow the science and believe in these, like, scientific theories and stuff.
Yeah, it's
and
definitely
keep them within the religion.
It actually mirrors to me a big argument that you get when you talk to some communists and all that about capitalism, right? And they say, well, listen, we have welfare, we have old-age security, right? So obviously you're wrong. And they say, well, yes, but they give a little so that they can keep the whole pie. And in a way, you've got the church saying, okay, we're going to give up a little bit here. But in doing so, we get to maintain the structure as we have it. There's another actually interesting aspect of this. I used to watch an old show called Yes, Prime Minister and Yes, Minister, which is a 1980s political show. But they made a lot of fun about the Anglican Church in England, about how it's not really a religious church. It's more of a political, social movement. And you get that. If you take a look at the places where there's a lot of atheism, Scandinavia, the northern countries, lots and lots of atheists. But surprisingly enough, lots and lots of churchgoers, that somehow that the church has evolved from a religious institution into a cultural institution. And I think this is part of what you're seeing in England right now, is that the God, the religion, isn't so important, but it's like we have this tradition. It's the Anglican Church. We've had it for hundreds of years. It's a way to get together as a community and stuff.
Okay, well, why don't we take a break, and we'll be back with more on Radio Freethinker.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Tuesday, February 23rd, beginning at sunset in Montreal, broadcasting live on your local campus and community radio station.
Sometimes we get that instant homelessness. We didn't expect to be homeless, and we find ourselves on the street because of an eviction or a notice.
Canada's largest talk show on poverty and homelessness.
We have a mayor who compared poor people to pigeons publicly and said that if you stop feeding them, they'll go away.
The 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, broadcasting February 23rd to 24th. A 14-hour live radio show from frozen street corners across Canada. Call in live, join the discussion.
Our demand from the federal government is $2 billion a year for social housing units across Canada. That'll just help us to start catching up to the 15 years that we've lost in building social housing in this country. It's really a glaring example of the negligence of the government.
Visit www.ckut.ca for more info.
The Homelessness Marathon will be broadcasting live from Vancouver on Tuesday, February 23rd at 8 p.m. as CITR 101.9 FM partners with CJSF 90.1 FM and Co-op 102.7 FM to bring you an hour of interviews and stories of how the 2010 Olympics are affecting homelessness in Vancouver. Visit CITR.ca for more information.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. Well, why don't we take a look at our off-overflowing email bag? I said off.
That was a lie.
Shut up.
Please email us if you have any questions, comments about the topics of the show, radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Now that we have an hour-long format, we'd like to know what you'd like to hear on the show, so let us know.
Okay, well, this email comes from Andrew Ataro in Calgary, and he writes, "Howdy, Radio Freethinker. I have a question for you for your podcast discussion. Some people that I know, whom are devoted believers in spirituality, the law of attraction, positive thinking, and the like, offer as evidence for their argument an experiment that allegedly proves that molecules of water can be altered with thought, prayer, and emotion. Can you shed some light on this questionable research?" Well, actually, we can. How about that?
we actually encountered, I think, this very research that she might be talking about when we were at the psychic fair last year. There were those quantum bracelet people, and they were saying that it was endorsed by this Japanese scientist who basically had found that by imbuing different emotions into water, he could change their crystalline structures.
Yes. Well, I did a bit of research, and I might be the same fellow, but there is a guy, you know, maybe he'd call him a quack, maybe not, Masaru Emoto, who claims he can alter the molecules of water by writing nice things on paper and taping them to the glass.
So, I'm a little confused here. I'm gonna play the dumb guy. So when you say alter the molecules of water, what does that mean?
Well, his website basically shows pictures of water under a microscope, like the molecules, and goes, wow, they're really ugly. And then he shows you molecules of water that have been treated. I guess someone taped, you know, like happy unmasking tape and froze it or something. And the molecules are all like pretty and crystalline and, you know, happy looking. And it's, woo, yay, I want to drink that water, not the dirty, evil looking water. So, yeah, I mean, this is pretty pseudoscience-y. I mean, there is absolutely no way that something you write on a glass is going to affect the content of water.
Like, it's the sort of thing where people call for the testing of these kinds of claims. Like, yeah, you should put, you know, the magic paper on top of the different things of water and then look at them, you know. But first, you have to sort of make a plausible mechanism.
If you're going to say, okay, like, I mean, this is, like, never mind taping something to the glass. How can thoughts, good vibrations, so to speak, affect the physical world without a, like, physical mechanism affecting it?
Well, this would be the major problem of pseudoscience.
Okay, yeah. I know, and you know, I play devil's advocate here just to be an ass, and I do the role so well. but why isn't it possible? I mean, lots of people believe that my thoughts can affect things around me. I mean, you guys are making claims, and where do you base your claims from?
Well, if you look at the natural world, for example, you know, if I think really hard about that pen over there, I can't make it levitate to my hand, unless, of course, reach out and grab it.
One of the people who have kinetic abilities.
Yeah.
Don't have enough mitochondrion.
Yeah.
Midichlorians, perhaps?
Midichlorians. Well, actually, I was hoping to go. Is you're right. I mean, this has actually been researched to death. If you ever watched any science-y, quote-unquote, show in the 70s, they're always talking about ESP, telekinetics, distance perception.
In the 60s and 70s, there was a ton of money being pumped into research into psychic phenomena. The U.S. government actually
spent about $20 million on it by the CIA. I mean, yeah, there's been a lot of research into, you know, psychic telekinetic powers. I mean, the funny thing too with this, I mean, if you take a glass of water, there's lots of molecules of water in there. I'm sure you can find some happy-looking molecules, some sad-looking molecules. You can probably find ones with, like, the Batman symbol if you look hard enough.
Well, you know, and there's also the confounding issues, right? I mean, depending on how water freezes determines its structure, what impurities happen to be in that water as well, right?
Exactly. If you put a, you know, tablespoon of salt, you'll get a different result. So, I mean, yeah, if you can imbue water with, you know, the power of positive emotion, I think that would show up in some controlled laboratory studies. I have no idea if this Masaru Emoto has done, you know, double-blind studies on the matter. I don't know if he's published anything in a peer-reviewed journal article, although who knows if that would help at all.
More on that later.
There's also the other aspect, too, that, okay, let's pretend somehow you managed to change the crystalline structure of water with your happy thoughts. Then comes the next claim.
Or you do it with some sort of memory.
Yeah, but, okay, then what? I mean, water is still chemically water.
Yeah.
And when it goes into your system, it's no longer crystalline. I don't know if you know this, but most people, if you're alive, have a body temperature above freezing point. So
I have heard that, yes.
You know, so again, he's not making any claim that he's actually changing the chemical structure of it, which would be a whole quantum issue.
If I could believe that. Like, if he was saying that I'm putting in a chemical to make the water more watery or tasty or something like that, okay, you've physically altered the substance. But just thinking about it, again, there is no physical connection there. I mean, you could maybe make the argument, okay, well, you know, if I reach out, if I'm thirsty, I can reach out and grab it. But that's your thoughts influencing your brain, influencing your nervous system, picking up the glass. We're talking about water just being, you know, there it goes, right?
Well, here's the go-to pseudoscience argument: quantum mechanics.
And that's what the people at the Psychic Fair were saying, that it works through quantum mechanics, because anything can happen when quantum mechanics are involved.
Although, of course, you know, this is also really good, too. Now, I'm sure some of our listeners are budding scientists. They're frustrated scientists. They're working at Starbucks, maybe, and they want to make that real big scientific breakthrough. Well, here is a great opportunity for you to sit there and make some ice cubes and put happy thoughts on some of the ice cubes and bad thoughts on the others, and then give them to your friends and assess their their response. Or actually, you technically should do a double-blind response, so you should get one of your friends to do it.
Okay, well, why don't we go to a quick commercial break, and we'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Okay, how about you say that on air?
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. And Don, do we have a call?
Yes, we do. Hold on. I think you're on the air now.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. Hi. I remember way back in the 70s, I took a, what is it, was a grade 13 psychology course, and we were reading this incredible study on the prayer on plants. And it's a proven science, in fact, that prayer on plants produces healthier and happier plants. And since plants are mostly water, I think that there's something to it. But perhaps there's more than just writing something. I think it's about, putting energy out. And we certainly know that energy is something. So I'm very interested in looking into this much more myself.
Well, I have to ask you, though. I mean, with thinking about, say, plants or water or anything, though, you still need a mechanism for your thoughts to influence anything. And, I mean, maybe if you think more about your plants, you're going to water them more. Maybe that is the
connection. Watering more kills more plants than anything else, actually. But I think that there's something within the vibrations of our thoughts and thoughts going to words, and this is what good...
So, actually, you know, thinking about the idea that there's vibrations, you know, you're right in some ways, that there are a lot of things that we don't quite understand. And if you have this belief, that's a valid thing. But have you gone more into researching on it? You've done some things, and obviously one of the things that we talk about a lot is the idea that there is a lot of sort of pseudo-research out there, things that are anecdotal, because there is a lot, right? I mean, my grandmother used to like putting stuff under her plants and thought that they would help. And maybe it did somehow, but that's where you have to get in proper kind of research. So right. You're right. Could there be something to this? Maybe. Like I say, they've done lots of research about how music and all that can affect plants to a certain degree. So is there an area of research, sir? And actually, that's why I suggested someone could go out there and try and do some research into this if they want. Although the area of psychic energy, the idea of somehow imbuing that, that there has been a lot of research into that. Again, like I say, it's going back a few years now, 60s and 70s. But maybe if you think there's some other mechanism to it, then maybe if you do some research yourself into that and you email us into Radio Free Thinker, we can look at that and give a response to that.
I'd love to do it. And being a gardener, you know, this is definitely up my alley.
Okay.
I work with plants all the time, you know.
Well, thank you, caller, for your thoughts and suggestions. And we encourage other listeners to phone into Radio Free Thinker when you guys hear us talking about something and want to voice your opinion. Well, why don't we take a commercial break, and we'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
The Vancouver 2010 Cultural Olympiad, presented by Bell, is thrilled to present a concert event for the ages. Hal Wilner's Neil Young Project, February 18th and 19th at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre. An all-star tribute to Canadian rock legend Neil Young, featuring Lou Reed, Ron Sexsmith, Iron and Wine, Joan as policewoman, and members of Broken Social Scene. Hal Wilner's Neil Young Project, February 18th and 19th. Tickets at 1-800-TICKETS and tickets.com. For more info, visit vancouver2010.com/cultureolympiad.
And we're back on radio. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker, finally. So, we were just mentioning the whole process of peer review.
So, yeah, I went and did a little background research on how research works. I mean, I know a little about it from what I've been doing at the lab. But we've been talking all the show about how there's been a lot of research done into parapsychology and pseudoscientific things. And it turns out that there's actually a Society for Psychical Research. It was founded in the late 1800s, and it's basically peer-reviewed research into pseudoscientific claims. And on their website, they quote, they do investigations into human experiences that challenge contemporary scientific models. And before you sort of think, well, this must be full of quacks, actually, there's been quite a few famous skeptics involved on the council of the Society for Psychical Research, including luminaries such as Richard Wiseman, Susan Blackmore. And what they do is exactly this. They take these sort of pseudoscientific claims and put them to the test. And so far, from all the back issues that I've flipped through and what I've read about the society, they have yet to definitively prove any such claim.
You know, and that actually points out, I mean, one thing that's important about the scientific method, about being a critical thinker, is not to say just inherently, this is wrong, this can't happen. Because a lot of things, a lot of the revolutions in science were quote-unquote alternative science or pseudoscience, but at some point they have to put up or shut up. And that's, you investigate them. You investigate them to a certain point. If they prove to be fruitless, you move on. In fact, a lot of the great movements in science is proving their research wrong.
Yeah, actually, one of the main functions of science is to take claims and try to disprove them. You deliberately set up your hypotheses and your experiments to try and disprove your hypotheses. And if it doesn't, well, then all you can say is that the research is supported. You know, the research supports this hypothesis. And then if he keeps doing it, then maybe eventually it gets elevated to some kind of theory. But it takes a lot of work to do that in many different fields. Science is contingency.
In fact, that's one of the things why one of the big things in science, and something we're going to talk about, is the idea of peer review. And peer review is the fact, okay, I can, you know, you might say that I might be biased, because individual people are. And we know in the history of science there have been quite a number of fraudsters, but the general community isn't. And one of the ways it polices itself is at least the idea of replication and peer review, that sort of idea. Now, there have been some questions recently about the whole idea of peer-reviewed journals.
A number of people have reported this recent story that a group of stem cell researchers basically... I think it was a press release. I'm not sure. I can't get the story loaded up on my phone if someone could look it up. But it's a group of researchers are saying that the peer review process is being abused by stem cell researchers to keep out innovative and new stem cell research from being published in reputable journals.
I believe actually it was an open letter to the editor by 14 scientists. There were two other scientists mentioned in the article, which requires me to log in so I can't look at any more on my iPhone. Okay.
Before we go too much into this, I think we should tell our viewers who don't know the intricacies of peer review what exactly it entails.
Oh, good point. Peer review basically is when your lab or your research, you want to publish a paper on it. You write up your paper, do the best job you can, and then you send it off to submission to a journal. And then the journal will have some board of editors or an editor or something like that.
Journal, for example, Nature, there are a lot of very specialized journals, but Nature might be the one a lot
or
of people
Science.
Know about.
Those are the sort of the two big journals of the scientific field. And what the editors will do is send your paper off for review by other experts in that field or related fields. And those people will look at your paper, make comments on it, suggest changes or further experimentation that needs to be done. You'll get it back, you revise your paper, do whatever research needs to be done. It goes through this process for a while, and then after everyone is satisfied with it, only then does it get published.
In that system, there's also two different kinds of peer review. There's double blind, where neither side knows who's reviewing them or who published the paper initially. And then there's single blind, where the people reviewing it know who is publishing it, who wants to publish it, but no one ever really knows who is reviewing their paper.
And I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, when we use the word review, these aren't people who look at it and say, no, you've got the wrong answer. What they do is they look at it and say, okay, your methodology is sound, you haven't drawn conclusions that are not in the evidence that you provided, or, again, as you say, if you want to make this claim, maybe you need this extra bit of research. It's not actually saying, I agree or disagree with your claims. It's just, does this meet what I think is the proper standards of a well-researched paper?
Now, that's how it works in theory. But in practice, according to, for example, these scientists that wrote this open letter, the process is open to abuse. If a group of people don't want a particular paper to be published, they can keep an eye out for that kind of research. And because they're the only experts in the field, they can collude to keep it from being published by constantly marking it down in the reviews by basically saying, no, this isn't going to work, or this is a ludicrous idea.
It doesn't even have to be a collusion. You could get the idea of groupthink, whereas, you know, if let's use our thing we were talking about before about ice molecules, right? And we just say, well, there's no mechanism for it, therefore anything that comes across, you have to provide a mechanism, so I'm never going to publish this research paper. And it's not like a conspiracy. It's just you can get groupthink in there, right? And that can also be playing into it. Because I think that's where I think some of this peer review may have, the controversy over peer review may have some issues, is the fact that you can't get groupthink. But how would you solve the problem? I mean, peer review is necessary. Otherwise, you have every Tom, Dick, and Harry writing to the journal. The journal publishes it if they feel like it, because if the peer review committee doesn't do it, then it's literally just up to the editor and his whims, and you still get the bias there, would you not?
Well, there's been quite a few people who have discussed the merits and drawbacks of peer review. One source that I'm using for here is a blog by Cameron Nalen, who has written a post in response to this controversy over peer review, basically saying that it's entitled, "Is Peer Review Useful? Maybe, maybe not." And what his basic idea is that peer review, the point of it is to make sure that the research is sound, that the methodology and the conclusions are within the realms of what you can do based on the research you did, but also so that journals can publish papers that will be influential, useful, and so on and so forth. And there have actually been studies, numerous studies, done by independent research groups, and one recently that I believe was published in Nature or something like that, that basically suggests that peer review is not really good at that second part.
But Rob, I mean, like if I were to publish a paper reaffirming gravity, is that all that interesting? I mean, does Nature or Science want to give, you know, space in their journal to talking about something that's been proven time and time again? Wouldn't they rather talk about something that's sort of on the cutting edge?
You'd think so, but a lot of the time, journals will go with something they know is a sure bet. Sometimes editors don't want to publish controversial research because it will raise the ire of people who will then call for their journal to be removed or for an article to be retracted or something like that. And the other thing that Cameron in this blog argues is that one of the main uses of peer review is precisely the reviews that reviewers give you. Their suggestions for what needs work on the paper, methodological issues, or things like that. But you don't know who's giving them, and they never see the light of day. So some of the most useful parts of peer review, the very suggestions they're giving you, never actually get published. They serve to refine the paper, but you don't see how the research progressed. You don't see what possible issues with the paper might be, because again, in practice, not all researchers implement every single suggestion.
You know, and actually, that was the one thing, and again, it was in the original article in science.com, I think it was, where one of the people interviewed said that, you know, what we should do is we should publish all this other information. We should make it public and part of it. And I can see in a paper journal, that would be an issue, because you only have so many pages, it costs money. But in the age of the internet with electronic storage, I don't really see why you couldn't make this information available. One of the other criticisms was the idea of making the reviewers' names public. And they said that 1 out of 5 wouldn't review, if their name was public. And I go, I can live with that. If it was 4 out of 5, that would seriously hamper the process. But, you know, 1 out of 5 people don't want to have their name associated.
There are some issues with that, though, because one of the biggest problems with that is more junior scientists are not going to want to criticize senior scientists in their field who they might need to work with and get along with in the future for sort of their continued success. And so even if not everyone totally gets out of reviewing, they might soften the reviews a bit and sort of get rid of a lot of the usefulness of the peer review process.
Yeah, I think that's one of the benefits of the anonymity, but I still think that perhaps the reviews anonymously should be published, or at least made available to subscribers of the journal.
But if I could liken this to sort of perhaps something a bit different, but for example, like a movie. Some people love special features on their DVDs, right? All the behind the scenes, the storyboards,
the commentaries.
Some people, they just want the movie. And I mean, I have a lot of DVDs. Have I watched 1% of the bonus features on them? Probably not. I mean, I've watched the ones that I like, but do I need to know all this material? That if it goes into the paper eventually, makes the paper better, do I need to know all the proofreading and stuff?
Well, at the same time, you're not a movie maker. You're not an expert in the field of movies.
Right.
In the case of people who are reading these journals and basing the research off of it, then perhaps it would be more useful to them to be able to access what comments were made on the paper.
It also actually, I think, goes to another area that, like, right now we have a group of stem cell researchers. We have the climate deniers who say that same sort of thing is happening with climate research. If this stuff was open and available, then you could go back and you could say, listen, hey, there is bias here or there isn't bias here. It would be above. But because it's kept secret and then it's a culture of that for the idea of anonymity, then it's really he said, she said sort of thing. And if it was available, even if you didn't care about it, maybe 5 years it would be important. Or again, as Rob mentioned, researchers in the field might find it valuable to check on the process itself.
To carry on your analogy, people who want to read the commentaries can.
Yeah, I would agree. If you could have it both ways, that'd be fantastic. Have that information available. Again, though, I don't know if I see a terrible need for, again, not even just the average person like me, but even the average scientist. I mean, for a lot of bloggers, for instance, when they talk about something that's interest to them, they may not be an expert or even in the field of what they're talking about, but they just need to get, you know, what is the consensus of the community. They don't necessarily need to go through and say, okay, oh my goodness, well, you know, somebody thought this was terribly biased and somebody thought this, oh, this was just a terrible idea. They need the general community consensus, right?
But I know in some of our show notes, sometimes we're very good at this, sometimes we're not, but we put in a lot of links that never made it to our show. But they were things that we had read mm-hmm. that helped formed our opinion. And I'm sure the millions of people who read our blog, a huge majority of them don't ever follow the links. But the links are there if you want to know more about it.
It's the sort of due diligence. Put everything there so if someone wants to, they can track it.
But don't most journal articles or published papers actually have a sizable list of other studies that they've references, and usually nowadays don't most journals have like 18 authors as opposed to like 2 or 3 now?
It depends on the journal, but I mean the basic idea that some of the benefits of peer review are lost when you don't make the review available I think still stands.
This
is a topic for a show about the open science movement, but in the interest of sort of looking at this, I looked up journals of different kinds. There are peer-reviewed journals, there are non-peer-reviewed journals, and sort of look at how things are going and see if peer-review does seem to make a difference. One of the most famous, and I would say infamous, non-peer-reviewed journals, proudly non-peer-reviewed, is the journal Medical Hypotheses, published by a major medical journal publisher, Elsevier. And Medical Hypotheses have been in the news recently. I think in just this past September, for publishing AIDS denialism, basically. This very famous, I forget his name, AIDS denialist published his papers in Medical Hypotheses. Don is just...
So in a way, actually, you're pointing to another thing, too. And again, the great joy of the web is that even if we have peer-reviewed magazines, there are non-peer-reviewed magazines. But just like trying to alter the peer-review systems with the anonymity, there are benefits and there are risks to it, right? So, I mean, you have a non-peer-reviewed journal out there, which has sort of the freedom, I guess, if you want to use that term, to print whatever it wants. Right, but there's a risk to that. I mean, everyone says if you're a first year university student or a high school student or whatever, what does the teacher say? Don't go to Google or Wikipedia and use that as a primary source for your paper, because although the information's there, a number of times you can't be sure on the process to which it got there.
So it turned out that Elsevier withdrew these two AIDS denialism papers from Medical Hypotheses at the call of a lot of researchers, but it doesn't change the fact that, according to Ben Goldacre's blog here, they carried one almost surreally crass paper in which two Italian doctors argued that mongoloid really was an appropriate term for people with Down syndrome, after all, because they share many characteristics with Oriental populations. You might also remember two pieces discussing the benefits and side effects of masturbation as a treatment for nasal congestion. So, clearly this is an extreme example of how peer review will keep ludicrous research from being published and the scientific community becoming involved to make sure that things like AIDS denialism don't get published. But at the same time, there are plenty of peer-reviewed journals which are full of nonsense. And I give you as the major example, also published by Elsevier, Homeopathy. The journal is entitled Homeopathy, and just this, their most recent issue is their two-part issue describing the biological mechanisms of homeopathy. And if you've listened to our show at all, or are involved in critical thinking at all, you know that homeopathy is a crock, whether the journal is peer-reviewed or not.
Well, if it... Rob, in that case, though, are the peer reviewers of that particular journal, are they all homeopaths?
That's one of the other failures of peer review.
But is that a failure of peer review, or is it a failure of the editors of that journal to not do due diligence on the people they choose to be peer reviewers?
Actually, no, I wouldn't even say it's a failure, because, I mean, let's take this in context, right? Peer review is a system, right? So they are following the peer review system, and they're going to experts in the field of homeopathy. So these are experts in that field, and they agree with it. Now, the fact that it's entirely fiction, I could have a peer-reviewed journal of vampires, right? And it would still be peer-reviewed, but hopefully you would have the intelligence when you read this Journal of Vampirism to know that, oh, well, this is silly in the face of it, so I'm going to take that when I look at it.
Okay, but I guess that's kind of what I was trying to say, though. But I mean, like, it's not really a failure of the system, or that the system is broken. That's just that someone's manipulating the system to, you know, get bunk past.
You mean the sort of idea of garbage in, garbage out. If all your peer reviewers are homeopaths, then of course you're not going to get.
Yeah, I mean, let's take the worst possible case of peer review is that you've stacked the board with homeopaths. But I mean, that's the worst case. Average all. I mean, you might get one creationist, one homeopath in the pool of your peer reviewers for the average, you know, reasonably reputable journal. In that case, though, wouldn't the peer review process still be, I'd say, more beneficial than harmful?
So maybe peer review is useful, but without knowing who the reviewers are, we're not really sure how accurate it is, because they don't publish who their reviewers are.
Yeah.
So, again, perhaps another point in favor of the sort of publicization? Is that a word?
Publicized?
Publicized peer review, I guess.
Okay. Well, all right. I think that's a reasonable compromise on that issue.
Yeah. No, I think we all believe that the research should be made available most times, that peer-reviewed magazines have a good value, because sometimes I don't know enough about medicine. So at least I can have some degree of faith, and limited faith maybe, but still some degree of faith, that the Journal of American Medicine will be a better source than Bob next door. And that because of the internet, even if I do want to take alternative views, it's out there, and buyer beware, because you never know what you're going to get.
Well, how about we go to an ad or a station ID and come back to more on the ever-changing world of science.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio. where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker.
So we've been talking about how science and peer review sort of works, maybe doesn't work, maybe needs changing. But one major example of this that's recent is the DSM-5. So the DSM is the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual for the Diagnosis of Psychiatric Disorders. And every once in a while, they review it, change the way the diagnostics work, and send it out for comment amongst experts in psychology, clinical psychology, psychiatry, and so forth. And the scientific community basically discusses how these changes will work, what effects they'll have on diagnosis and the community, whether they should be made or not, and so on and so forth.
You know, actually, I should point out a conflict of interest here, because actually they're going to use my picture in that, because they have a thing, how to visually discern sane from insane, and they're using my picture. I'm not going to tell you which one, but...
I'm sure our listeners can guess. But the American Psychiatric Association, and basically it'll have new diagnoses, some changes to old ones, some will be removed. It's to be released in 3 years, so they're giving people a lot of time to discuss the changes.
And I know, actually, in the podcast sphere that I listen to, they've been talking about this for over a year or two now, talking about this is coming up, and it's going to be sort of game-changing and all that.
Well, I mean, won't this have a big effect on, for example, how many cases we say of autism there are?
That's one of the main things that's sort of being reported on in the changing. They're changing the way that spectrum disorders work. They're actually putting gradients for almost every disorder in the DSM, which, I mean, just seems to me to make much more sense that, you know, you can be on a spectrum of how far gone you are, to put it in a rather blunt way. But actually, they've been talking about how Asperger's syndrome might be being subsumed into the sort of the major autism spectrum, and it'll be renamed as just mild autism spectrum disorder.
You know, and you just know Jenny McCarthy's going to be out there, because the day after this is released, suddenly there are going to be a million more cases of autism in America, and they go, see, it's vaccines, when really it's a clerical change.
No, an association for people with Asperger's syndrome has actually called out, you know, that this is a negative thing, that they are part of a community. They have a name. They call themselves, you know, jokingly, Aspies. And now that the name is being removed, that they're changing it in the diagnostic manual, what's going to happen to the community? Does it still count? That, like, there's a lot of political changes that are happening here. In fact, one major change is, because I think the last DSM was made sometime in the 80s, they're changing mental retardation into a sort of... they're changing the name completely into sort of... in mild intelligence decline or something like that, because of the massive stigma attached to the name.
Well, actually, and you were mentioning political, and you mentioned Asperger's. Actually, on the flip side of that, some people have been pushing for this change, because if you have autism, then you're eligible for special funding, special treatment in the education system, whereas if you don't have that technical word, then you no longer qualify. And that's... So there's a yin and yang in some of this. But ultimately... will it actually be any better as a diagnostic tool than the old one? Or is this just all political correctness gone insane?
Well, that's one thing that we have the next 3 years to sort of discuss and decide. Actually, one thing that I thought was really interesting is the addition of a whole new kind of category of disorders, behavioral addictions, to cover things like gambling addictions and things like that, because they didn't used to be in there. And they're probably far more deleterious to your experience than some of the things in the DSM.
Well, and actually, from what I understand, too, is with modern medical research, the MRs and all that, right, is that they've discovered that a number of these gambling things will actually result in some physical changes to the biology, and that addiction may start off as sort of a voluntary thing, but it actually becomes not a disease, but there's another word, disorder, that would be in there. And it's good that they're taken into account, although if you're sick tomorrow, I guess this doesn't help you.
Well, I may already be sick because internet addiction was considered for being added into the DSM, but they decided that there wasn't enough evidence for or against it.
Weren't they also looking to put in video game addiction to this one?
Probably along the same lines as internet addiction.
Yeah, I'm sure it's broad spectrum addiction or something.
Well, I'm sure Jenny McCarthy will blame vaccines for that one too.
Yes.
Did you see that thing that Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy put out in response to the Andrew Wakefield's paper being removed from The Lancet?
Yes. It always amuses me that people prefer to go to a guy who's famous for bending over and talking out of his butt for medical advice. But, we're running out of time on Radio Free Thinker. I hope that our listeners enjoyed our hour-long show on our 50th episode. Well, what are our skeptical highlights for this week?
I have a skeptic highlight that's a highlight of my week. With the CFI Vancouver is hosting a discussion on free speech with me, myself, and I, as, yes, it's a tri-panel discussion, hosting it. We're going to talk basically about the idea of free speech. There's been a number of issues that have come up, in particular the pro-life campus club in University of Victoria is being denied its club status, and the BC Civil Liberties Union is getting involved in that. And just the idea is, what is free speech, where are the limits, and how should that be policed or not policed?
That sounds very entertaining.
That's also the 22nd of February, location to be announced.
Stay tuned for our webpage, Facebook, and the CFI calendar for
more
information.
It will be at 7 p.m., though.
Okay.
All right, then.
Skeptic Camp 2010 is coming up on March 20th, I believe. So you can go to skepticcamp.org and register for that. We'll be giving a talk there.
What are we going to be talking about?
I think we were discussing this at a meeting the other day, and we're going to be talking about our personal skeptical experiences within our field, sort of cross-disciplinary skepticism and how we've personally gotten involved in it.
In an effort to promote participation, if anyone has anything that they really think we should be talking about, please email us in at
radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Well, another event to promote, CFI is putting on a talk by Dr. Samantha Beck, and she will be explaining the genetic and epigenetic language. And this talk will be taking place at the Bottle Tipper restaurant, which is over on Kingsway, at 7 p.m. Saturday, February 27th. There is a Facebook group, and it's on the CFI calendar webpage. It's $5, $4 for students, free for CFI members. Check it out. Anything else? That's it.
We still got a little time left.
Well, I would like to remind all our listeners, please do email us. Please do become our fan on Facebook. Please do check out our webpage at www.radiofreethinker.com.
Actually, and now that we have the new hour-long format, there's two things that we're kind of playing with, and your feedback on this would be really good. We've been toying around with an idea of ask an expert or something like that, where if you have any questions, like we had this one caller today who had some questions about impressions and such, give us the questions, and we'll go out and we'll do the footwork, and we'll ask some expert. We'll find out, what is the physics behind this, or what is the history behind that. So send us any emails about any questions that bother you. I mean, or
we can do some of the legwork for you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we should mention to our listeners, please do not be alarmed if next week at this time you do not hear our show. We have not been canceled. We are merely on hiatus for 1 week. However, tune into our webpage for a very special bonus episode available only online.
Now, we should make it known that for almost the past year, Native Solidarity News has been the lead-in to our show. And now that we have an hour-long format, when we start at 3:30, we're preempting Native Solidarity News. So we'd like to thank you if you started listening to us after listening to Native Solidarity News. And if you'd like to continue listening to their show, you can go find it on cjsf.ca.
All right, well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist, saying see you later.
This is Daniel saying thanks for listening.
government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Fun!
While
Fun
cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains
Fun. Fun
devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled.